Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. We have got some Bitcoin story time coming at you today with another crypto quick read and read by your host, Guy Swan. That's me, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And I want to make an announcement first. I have gotten my tickets and I'm actually a sponsor now for the BitBlock Boom Conference. That will be happening on the weekend of August 17th and 18th. The main event and everything is on the 17th, and then they have a brunch and like networking hangout thing for a number of hours on the 18th. And I'm really, really excited about it. I already found out that a bunch of people that I got to hang out with and meet at the Bitcoin 2019 conference will be there. So I'm really excited. And if you want to join me, if you're thinking of coming on and coming out to Dallas and joining us at the BitBlock Boom Conference. I don't know why that's so hard to say. I have a discount code now. I can get you 30% off of that ticket. And right now, let's see what those are. There should be, see what the countdown is on the next time that the tickets increase. Okay, you got 15 days before the ticket prices increase again. And the coupon code or the discount code is CC for Cryptoconomy, just the double C, and that will give you 30% off the tickets. So if you want to come out to BitBlock Boom, do not forget about your discount code and be sure to get your tickets before 15 days from Tuesday, July 16th, before the beginning of August, so you can lock in the lower price. All right, so that's really exciting. And you'll get a goodie bag with my logo on it. What's up? And let's see, what are we jumping into today? We are hitting another one from Suzu and Hasu, which is, it's Hasu Fly, I think, actually, on, oh no, Hasu FL on Twitter. And, but these guys run or post a lot of things on uncommoncore.co. Sometimes I think it's just one or the other of them, but they write a lot of these things together. And they have an amazing series called The Skeptic's Guide to Bitcoin. And we've actually read all three of the pieces in that series on this show. In fact, what were they called? Let me check them out here. There was An Honest Account of Fiat Money was the first one. These are not in like right back to back is when we read these. They're pretty spread out. So actually, I'll link to these in the show notes so you can find them on anchor.fm and go to the actual episodes page. But it's An Honest Account of Fiat Money, Unpacking Bitcoin's Social Contract, and Independent Property Rights. And all three of them are amazing. I think my favorite out of the three is Independent Property Rights. But I think the first two are actually a really good lead-in to like kind of a foundation for understanding the independent property rights argument. But I really love that article. That one's just a wonderful one for analogies on what the value of Bitcoin is and what it's actually competing against. Because people have these ideas that it's, oh, we're competing against Visa, we're competing against the dollar, and it's not exactly true. It's a stack of things that Bitcoin makes possible. And I really think the independent property rights article is one of the best at breaking down that concept. So I really love that one. And we are reading today one of their newer, one of their more recent articles, though it was still is published back in March 6th. So it's not exactly brand new, but it's Investing in Bitcoin. And it's digging a lot deeper into a number of the concepts on why Bitcoin is valuable. How do we value it? And it's going to be a really, really fun one. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into Hasu's and Suzu's article on uncommoncore.co, investing in Bitcoin. We don't talk much about price in this blog, but we will make an exception today to show how to value Bitcoin using a high-level approach. We'll highlight three significant trends in the world and suggest how either one of them could lead to increased demand for neutral, private money in the future. How to value Bitcoin. On a long enough time frame, valuing Bitcoin is straightforward. The market finds a price based on available supply and demand. When more people want to buy Bitcoin than sell it, the price goes up, and vice versa. For most types of assets, a price increase entices producers to make more of it, pushing the price back down. Likewise, a price decrease leads to a decrease in supply, making the price go back up. As a result, most goods tend to be relatively price stable near their cost of production. Bitcoin has a fixed supply. There will only ever be 21 million units, and we always know how many of them exist. The market can still try to create substitute goods, like other cryptocurrencies with similar properties, to increase the supply. We fully expect this to continue to happen, but money has immense brand value in the form of network effects, liquidity, and integration in existing financial infrastructure. Bitcoin's supply isn't entirely inelastic to changes in demand, but certainly less so than other assets, leaving upside to be captured by existing owners rather than producers. The sum of all Bitcoin multiplied with their price is called market capitalization. Comparing market caps of assets like fiat currency, real estate, stocks, or commodities allows us to see how much value people store in them at any given time. Bitcoin's market cap today is $80 billion, which is small compared to what we could see as potential target markets to disrupt. U.S. dollar notes held abroad are around $1 trillion, including over 75% of all $100 bills in existence. Global base money is $19.6 trillion. Gold held for investment purposes around $1.1 trillion privately, excluding jewelry, and $1.3 trillion held by central banks. Since the supply of Bitcoin and substitute goods is less responsive to changes in demand, we expect rising demand to manifest in a higher exchange price. We see three primary sources of such future demand. Demand for digital cash. 90% of all money today is virtual. It is created when someone takes a loan and henceforth lives on a bank ledger until the debt is paid and the money destroyed or it is withdrawn as cash. The growing trend away from physical cash to digital payments is understandable. Cash has the annoying property that you need to be in the same location to exchange it. Most of us are also paid digitally for the work we do, so to pay in cash, one would have to constantly replenish it. Countries that have abandoned the use of physical cash altogether are called cashless. It can happen without coercion, like in Sweden. In other countries, like India, the government has demonetized larger denomination banknotes. In China, digital payments serve as a tool of social control and the backbone for a new social credit system. Central banks around the world are enthralled by the idea of negative interest rates, the ultimate holy grail of monetary control. In a cashless society, they can directly tax people's bank accounts to disincentivize saving and encourage, quote, aggregate spending in the form of consumption and investment. Digital payments are highly efficient and convenient, but they are not money when it comes to the properties that our parents and their parents have been used to. It is a new form of money that makes very concrete trade-offs. Digital payments receive their efficiency gains from including a trusted third party in every transaction that maintains a central ledger that it can much easier update when told to. This arrangement doesn't come without drawbacks. The intermediary monitors all financial activity, can refuse transactions he disagrees with, or even confiscate funds altogether. Cash, on the other hand, can be exchanged peer-to-peer between people. The transactions are permissionless, private, and immediately final. No one can revert them after the fact. As our reliance on financial intermediaries grows, so does the importance of who controls them. Today, a small number of payment companies have a disproportionately large impact to define what speech is acceptable online and what businesses should be allowed to operate. Money is the lifeblood of the economy. Someone who is cut off by payment processors loses his autonomy and almost any chance to run his business. Every year, the world is moving closer towards going cashless. The reason, in our opinion, is that the benefits of digital payments are immediate and visible to the user, while the downsides are invisible until they matter. As a consequence, the global supply of physical cash will continue to drop. This drop, however, is not an accurate reflection of the demand to hold it. Governments, central banks, and large corporations have an incentive to push for a cashless society, though not all of them do, while cash has no coordinated commercial interest backing it. Demand for cash is also underrepresented as long as financial intermediaries can be wholly trusted, which isn't guaranteed to last forever. It seems unnecessary, like fire insurance, until it burns. Bitcoin is the first and only form of money that offers cash-like properties but can be stored and transferred digitally. When governments no longer provide physical cash, there could be a lot of excess demand for an asset with cash-like properties looking for a release valve, and Bitcoin is in a unique position to offer that. Demand for a global, neutral settlement network. Digital payments work for parties who have a middleman that they can trust. Since World War II, the U.S. has been this trusted middleman for most of the developed world. Lately, the U.S. has shown they are willing to weaponize the financial system to command their political will by pressuring SWIFT into cutting off Russia and Iran as part of their sanctions. It is not well received by their allies. Additionally, political moods in most countries are turning towards isolationism, both in Europe, with Brexit and revolts in France, as well as the U.S., the trade war with China, threats to leave nuclear arms treaty with Russia. U.S.-led soft power institutions like the WB, IMF, and WTO are gradually losing their influence. These were the main tools for projecting U.S. power abroad, and their disenfranchisement will leave power vacuums and uncertainty in their wake. We believe the world is currently moving away from having one trusted protector and intermediary to a multipolar world order. As frictions between world powers increase, the willingness to trust financial infrastructure controlled by someone else will decrease. That creates demand for a financial network that is not controlled by one party, but is politically neutral. Even online, censorship is on the rise. China's internet is effectively cut off from the rest of the world, and Russia is planning to follow suit. Bitcoin fulfills the conditions of being neutral and censorship-resistant. While in the past controversial activity found a home in Bitcoin, like Silk Road and WikiLeaks, the world could wake up to the benefits of censorship resistance as a positive trait that is no longer, quote, just for criminals. All right, I'm going to need a break to get out of this heat and get myself a drink. So I'm going to air out my Bitcoin blankie fort. We will hit our sponsor, and we will jump right back into this piece by Hasu Fly and, or Hasu and Suzu at uncommoncore.co, Investing in Bitcoin. Demand for a hedge against the failure of the existing system. Many people are worried about the over-leveraged state of the world economy and our financial system. Both consumer and sovereign debt levels are at all-time highs relative to GDPs, while interest rates, especially in Europe and Japan, are still zero. When the economy slows down, there is little that central banks can do to ease the pain and kickstart the economy. Further, a widespread shift in demographics has created a massive gap between future government liabilities and income from taxes. For example, the U.S. government doesn't just owe $20 trillion in sovereign debt, but 10 times as much in domestic debt in the forms of entitlement programs. Many believe that the only way to pay up is by throwing the U.S. dollar under the bus and devalue it to meet at least nominal obligations. Given this is a doomsday scenario and not very fun to think about, but it's a reality that any investor has to deal with today. Gold has traditionally been a trust anchor when investors flee out of fiat currency, but it is also highly co-opted by governments and hard to secure and repatriate, as some countries experience today. We believe that over a long enough time frame, Bitcoin can become the gold of the internet-native generation and take its place as a hedge against government and central bank failures. Bitcoin as doomsday insurance is a narrative that is picking up steam and that is now commonly cited even by skeptics such as Ken Rogoff as a primary use case of Bitcoin. As more people are getting worried about systemic risk, demand for Bitcoin as limited, quote, insurance tickets could rise accordingly. That Bitcoin does, in fact, work as an exit ramp for weak local currencies can be seen in Venezuela and other South and Central American countries, where Bitcoin is increasingly adopted, quote, on the ground as an alternative to the U.S. dollar. A recent study about global data from the peer-to-peer exchange Local Bitcoins found that, quote, in the fourth quarter of 2018, as Bitcoin price and interest seemed to hit their doldrums, 23 countries on LBC had their best quarters ever. Almost all of these countries are in the developing world, end quote. The U.S. dollar is still the most sought-after black market currency, but Bitcoin is better at some things that make it an attractive alternative for people in developing countries. It's easier to protect against confiscation, for example using a brain wallet, and transfer digitally, especially across borders. Skeptics of Bitcoin often miss the fact that currency competition is like running from a bear. You only have to outlast your slowest friend. Bitcoin, in its current immature form, competes with the weakest of fiat currencies, not with the US dollar, euro, or Japanese yen, and does so despite its price volatility. Is Bitcoin's volatility a problem? I'm often asked if Bitcoin's price volatility will prevent adoption. Bitcoin is volatile for two reasons. First, Bitcoin's supply is fixed and doesn't react in changes to demand. Second, as a young currency, it is mainly used for speculation today. Its price is a function of deferred expectations of growth and expectations of other people's expectations, and so on, all of which get revised all the time. The best way to think about volatility is as a temporary transaction cost. As Bitcoin's market capitalization grows, less of its value will be from speculation, as there is less future growth to bet on, and more from fundamental usage. That will lower Bitcoin's volatility and make it cheaper to use. While it can be seen as a chicken-egg problem initially, Bitcoin needs adoption to become price stable, but many forms of adoption require price stability. Using Bitcoin has a different value to different people. Bitcoin's success as money shouldn't be judged by its ability to perform consumer payments. Instead, Bitcoin is first adopted by those who can tolerate the costs because it helps them better than existing alternatives, or because there are no alternatives. With every additional group of people Bitcoin serves, it becomes less volatile and cheaper to use, making it more attractive for use cases which are slightly more price sensitive. A positive feedback loop. The fact that anyone uses Bitcoin today despite its volatility and complexity is amazing to me and should be seen as a ringing endorsement by the market. Summary. Bitcoin is a new financial network with a token, also called Bitcoin but with a lowercase b, that is currently in its monetization phase. During this phase, Its price is largely determined by expectations of future growth, making it expectedly volatile. Despite the cost and complexity, people use Bitcoin on the ground today in developing countries and to make unstoppable transactions online. The more people use it, the less volatile it will become, encouraging further adoption. Since Bitcoin's supply is fixed and substitute goods are hard to make, the price is largely a function of the demand to hold it. We identified three major trends in the world that could lead to significant demand down the road. Demand that Bitcoin is well positioned to serve, often as the only competitor, and that could create significant upside for existing holders. Thank you to Nick Carter for his excellent feedback. Disclaimer: this content should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. You should consult your advisors as to legal, business, tax, and/or other related matters concerning any investment. Furthermore, this content is not directed at nor intended for use by any investor or prospective investor and may not under any circumstances be relied upon when making investment decisions. All right, and that concludes Investing in Bitcoin, a piece, another great piece by Hasu and Suzu on uncommoncore.co. And I've linked, or I will link to the other three parts of the Skeptic's Guide to Bitcoin series, as well as another one we actually read of theirs, the Bitcoin is a hedge. Bitcoin is a hedge against the cashless society, which this kind of extends that concept, this article does. So really, really good stuff up on uncommoncore.co. I definitely, definitely encourage you to check those guys out and follow Hasu as well as Suzu on Twitter. I will link and post all that good stuff. You'll be able to find their tags right there in the Twitter post, as well as at the actual show notes page. All right, so let's hit a couple of these topics here, because this lays out a really great, like, kind of macroeconomic, like, that high-level view of some of the major shifts that are happening in society, and really on, like, kind of a decades-long time frame here that we're looking at, and then showing where Bitcoin kind of fits into all of this. And the first one, which they talk about at length in the Hedge Against Cashless Society article that we've covered in the past, is about the demand for digital cash. And this is a really great, I love this line in particular, and they're referring here to the sort of underrepresented demand for cash. But they said, quote, "The reason, in our opinion, is that the benefits of digital payments are immediate and visible to the user, while the downsides are invisible until they matter," end quote. And I really, really like that argument because that's exactly the truth. When you're moving into the digital space, all you see is the convenience. All the trade-offs that you're actually making are completely invisible. You don't really see that. You don't see the risk of trusting someone else with whether or not you can transact or with your money as an immediate risk that you're taking. When you see it in your app, you're used to just thinking, okay, here's my balance. This is the money that I have. It's not until it's taken away. It's not until they call you, they freeze a payment and call you up and ask you, why are you making this payment to so-and-so? It's not until they threaten to shut down your bank account because you transacted with the wrong country or something like that. Like that cost is invisible until it literally slaps you in the face. So for the most part, everybody is adopting it out of convenience without realizing the massive amount of power they are losing in the process because they just want a cheap, easy way to pay for something online or pay their friend, et cetera, et cetera. And so even though, I thought that was a really good way to explain why, even though there's a huge drop in the demand for physical cash or just cash in general, is that it's actually not an accurate reflection of the demand to hold it. It's just a reflection of the fact that the costs, the downsides to this are invisible, and the benefits are immediate and completely transparent. And I think that they're right, particularly as governments, China, Russia, the US, the UK, like all of these, all the modern world, because the financial situation is in such dire straits, they are going to be reining in very tightly as much control over people's transactions and capital as they can, because otherwise they are going to pay the price, and they don't want to. They don't want to give up their power, so they're going to figure out how to make other people pay for it. And they do that by promoting and pushing the cashless society, where they essentially are running the puppet strings behind everything. They can decide whose accounts get locked and who actually owns their money and who does not. And just like with the case of massive financial liabilities, is they're going to devalue the dollar. And they can only, the point of that, to devalue the dollar, is to make it so that everyone who is holding the dollar, everyone who is using the dollar, everyone who is getting paid in the dollar, that their value is sucked up to pay for the government's and the central bank's irresponsibility. Because that's the thing they don't want. They don't want to lose their central bank, because that means they pay for their irresponsibility. It's a whole lot easier if you just starve your population and keep your power. So that's what they'll do. They'll kill the currency. They'll run the puppet strings and make sure that they are the ones telling the bank exactly who owns their money and who can and cannot transact. And because all of this is coming to a head, because it's inevitable that the debt has to get paid back or something has to break somewhere, that type of power is going to be exerted in a far stricter and far more totalitarian way. And the demand for digital cash is going to explode. The demand to have something that is digital, that is outside of the realm of their manipulation, of their attempting to push the cost of that onto other people who did not make the decisions, who did not destroy the economy, who did not run up hundreds of trillions of dollars in debt. People will not put up with that. Like, people will be out for survival of themselves, not less their political ideology. Like, if they have some, like, force somebody else to pay for it, or like I have like everybody should pay their taxes ideology, when they are starving, when they can't put food on the table, they are going to gladly give up their belief that they should be paying taxes in order to survive. And in the same way, they're going to gladly give up the fact that they should be using the U.S. dollar for everything. They'll probably still promote it. They'll probably still scream it to everyone else. It's like, no, the dollar is our country. But they'll have Bitcoin or some real asset that is not even, that's not being bled dry of all of its value, so that they don't die. And that's exactly what digital cash does. It's a bearer instrument that allows someone to hold value without a political institution being able to destroy it through nothing more than political authority, because that's what they're doing in the alternative. Is they're simply saying that all of the value is because we allow you to have it based on our authority, and digital cash is, we have the value, you have to figure out how to get it from us. It's a complete shift in the power dynamics. One is you're allowed to have value. The other is I have value. You have to explain why I'm giving it up, or you have to take it from me. And that's a very, very different, that's a very different power dynamic. And I think without question, there is no way that that demand does not increase substantially. And it already is, because guess what? People don't like to be slaves. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about political authority deciding who, what, when, and where things can happen, value should move, and what vision of the world should be funded. And people aren't going to put up with that. They might still wave their flag or vote for this person or that person, but when it comes to their own lives and their own freedom, they will prioritize themselves, and they will seek to find that freedom and independence for themselves, regardless of what any politician or anyone says. It's going to cause massive growth, in my opinion, in exactly those things, the black markets, which will just be the moral market, as opposed to the politically authoritative market. or the voluntary market, I guess, is probably the better word. Like, because you think about it, like, when we're talking about the black market in this scenario, we're talking about all the quote unquote extra legal market, which means that every time that, you know, some young person in your neighborhood comes through and like cuts your grass and you pay them cash and, you know, you don't report it and they don't report it, that's the black market. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about people who are trading and just not telling everything exactly to the government. Now, obviously, it includes things that are socially unacceptable or social pariahs like prostitution and drugs and stuff like that. But the vast majority of it, when we're talking about just cash transactions and what will be largely the same experience probably in digital cash, where people are just doing small under-the-table transactions so that they are not being robbed blind every time they get a paycheck, or so they, you know, they sell their couch without reporting the quote-unquote income, you know, that kind of thing. When people are producing a little bit on the side, like I think it actually makes sense that this would increase with the kind of hyper-specialization that we're getting with the expanse of the internet markets and like the gig economy and all of these things, is that this will help to push the demand for digital cash, because people will be looking for alternative ways to make and earn money where it is not being destroyed. Because if whatever your quote unquote open market, your legitimate market job is, if the pay that you get from that is constantly being destroyed, is being fined and taxed 13 different ways, then you're not going to like stop wanting your life to be better. You're not going to stop wanting to have savings, and you're not going to stop caring about the fact that you're completely uncertain about your situation in 1 week. That, you know, if you had a flat tire, you might be absolutely financially ruined for the next 2 years because you had an unexpected $300 purchase. And a lot of people are pretty much in that situation already because of the debt bubble that our crap economic policies and price controls has pushed onto the economy. So we're already teetering on the edge. And now we're talking about like a collapse of that debt bubble because we've got interest rates at zero and they still can't prop this thing up. Like, it's not going to get any better. And people are not going to seek to get less from what they produce. You know, they're trying to keep the freaking world running. They're trying to stay fed and keep their families fed. And these people are just going to stand by and watch their currency lose 90% of its value, or have what little savings they actually do have confiscated through negative interest rates that, like, you know, you can't, they can't move it, or they can't like withdraw it. The populations are not going to keep up or put up with that. It's just not going to happen. We've already got this huge increase in uncertainty and loss of trust in all of these institutions. And when the price gets clearer and clearer and gets phenomenally larger and more obvious, that trust will break down completely. And people will seek something. That's one of the other major sources of demand here for Bitcoin that they talk about is its apolitical nature. It's the fact that it's completely outside of the political world. It's like a hedge. It's like gold as a insurance ticket for the failure of the existing system, which I think is becoming more and more obvious. And I'm glad that they mentioned that it's not just about the $20 trillion in general debt that is to be concerned about. We're also talking about just an unbelievable amount, literally near or a little bit over $100 trillion or more in domestic debt, that they think that we're going to have all of these welfare and liability programs, like these unfunded liabilities for all of the programs just for people in this country. Like, they're not going to get their pensions. These people are not going to get their Social Security. And just as they said, they will make sure it's paid for in the nominal sense. You'll get the actual dollars, but they won't be worth anything. I don't think it's politically feasible for them to say, oh, whoops, we screwed up and we can't pay for any of this crap, so we're not going to pay it. What they'll do is they'll send you the check for the $50,000 that they promised you would get out of Social Security or whatever it is, but that $50,000 will not be enough to buy a cart's worth of groceries. When the bill for those when those liabilities actually get priced in, it will not buy you hardly anything. That's what will happen. There is simply no way to pay off the liabilities. Like, it's absurd. And the fact that we're teetering on the edge of any kind of stability while we have deeply, deeply underpriced interest rates already, like, there's nowhere to go. So it's, I don't know, our financial system, our financial situation is such a massive problem. I think that demand alone for Bitcoin being a neutral in the sense that it is not controlled, it is not inside this financial system, and it's not, what's the word? It's not exposed to all of those liabilities. Like, there's no, you know, no Bitcoin in the system is backed by someone else's debt. Almost all of the U.S. dollar is. If these debts come due and they don't work out, like if they don't get paid, there's going to be a massive collapse. We are building, all of our supposed financial stability is built on promises that we know no one can pay back. So it's just this giant illusion. It is the definition of a bubble, and it's going to come crashing down, and you will have to have some sovereign form of value in order to escape it. Otherwise, you are an involuntary payer of that debt, of someone else's debt and irresponsibility. And then this quote here, because another huge thing is just the demand for the global neutral settlement network, because SWIFT and, well, let me go ahead and I'll read the quote and then kind of expand on it a little bit here. So, quote, U.S.-led soft power institutions like the WB, the IMF, and the WTO are gradually losing their influence. These were the main tools for projecting U.S. power abroad, and their disenfranchisement will leave power vacuums and uncertainty in their wake. We believe the world is currently moving away from having one trusted protector and intermediary to a multipolar world order. End quote. I think this is a really, really powerful statement, and I think it's absolutely right. I think what we are seeing right now is the breakdown of trust, the breakdown of that what has essentially been a one world government in the modern sense for quite some time, really, largely since World War II, arguably more potently since like the early 70s, I think. But these institutions that they haven't exerted a lot of power before. These are all, you know, extrajudicial institutions. Like nobody, these institutions, when they exert power, they're destroying the sovereignty of all of these individual countries. Like nobody votes for these. Like I don't vote for the people in the IMF or like these huge overarching like global regulatory agencies that say, oh, these people or these companies have to share this certain information about customers with everybody between these other countries. Like we don't get the vote. Like these aren't representatives. These are just authoritative structures that decide that this is how it's going to be. And because they run the rails, they are the ones with the puppet strings for the SWIFT institution, the settlements network. They've always threatened their power, essentially, to cut people out of the, you know, modern financial system. So it's like, you know, imagine, think of it sort of in the sense like you could just cut someone's internet off if they started misbehaving. You could disconnect them and make them unable to access the internet. Well, we've got the equivalent of that with a global settlement network because we really only have one. It is a highly controlled, highly centralized global financial settlement. And that's exactly what needs to be replaced. And there will be massive demand for anything that competes with that that can't be controlled. Because the more that these institutions actually exert their control, the more they restrict what people can do and which countries can settle or can use this network, well, then the more people they are pushing out, forcing them to find an alternative. And Bitcoin literally is the only trust-minimized alternative out there, the only one that is jurisdictionless and stands any chance, it seems right now, to stand up against some of these nation states or these large multinational institutions that think they run everything. And so it's only going to increase the pressure for building and using exactly those sorts of alternatives as their, because they lose their influence, they're going to grab onto it tighter. You know, it's just this kind of how power is when it's when they start to exert it really, really forcefully and aggressively that you know they're losing it because they have to cling onto it as hard as they can, hoping that it doesn't fall away from them. But it's slipping through the cracks. It's like trying to hold water in your hand. It's just going to leak out no matter what they do. And because of that, like when they're with Iran and Russia, like they're trying to essentially knock them out of the, you know, modern financial networks, well, what are these countries going to do? They're going to build alternatives. They're going to figure out how to use alternatives. They're not going to sit with their thumbs up their butt and just pretend, just be like, oh, well, I guess we're all just going to starve to death and we're not going to be part of, you know, the modern world and we'll just, you know, cut our internet off while we're at it. No, they're going to seek an alternative. They're going to figure out how to use something else, which is funny because this could very well lead to another one of the ways I think Bitcoin will be demonized in the short term is that all of these countries that are being pushed out of the global financial system, all these countries that are being hit with sanctions and stuff, will start to use something like Bitcoin, will start to use the alternative financial infrastructure, and then they'll doubly get to associate it, like the U.S., these multinational or international organizations in the United States, when they start getting their marketing campaign against Bitcoin because it starts to threaten their power hold, they will use the fact that, look, North Korea is using Bitcoin. Look, Russia is using Bitcoin. Look, Iran is using Bitcoin. It's like, well, no shit, because you cut off their only alternative. So they're using it because it's the one thing that you can't control. And they'll claim, look how evil Bitcoin is. So I think this is probably going to be a big part of the marketing campaign against Bitcoin when the Fed starts to realize that they can't make whatever monetary decision they want because Bitcoin is, you know, that elephant in the corner of the room that says, we're going to soak up all your value if you do something stupid. So I think it's very likely to expect massive demand just because of Bitcoin's incredible neutrality and the fact that it is a global system that cannot be censored. I think the fact that people in Iran are using it, the fact that people in Venezuela are using it, the fact that people in North Korea are using it, and China, these are proofs of concept of this incredible value potential. And it is in no way a deterrent or a negative thing for Bitcoin. It's proof of Bitcoin's unbelievable neutrality and the fact that it is absent of any jurisdiction, that it is absent of any single authority's control. It's outside of that reach. And I think that's an incredibly powerful statement and a position that makes it worth arguably tens of trillions of dollars. I absolutely think that this, just these three things alone, like just these major trends that are happening in the economy and in the world, in the modern financial world, I think these are enough for it to be vastly more valuable than gold is right now. I think it's a better hedge. I think it's a hedge that's looking toward the future and the fact that it's going to get easier and vastly more capable because it's a programmatic, like it's a programmable money. It is a totally digital. It can be transported across any border without having to transport anything physical. You can just memorize a seed phrase and move to another country. I think its benefits over the past alternatives that hedged against problems like this and tried to actually put a check on these massive imbalances that we're having to deal with, I think Bitcoin is vastly, vastly better at proving its neutrality, its lack of borders, its censorship resistance, its capacity for digital exchange and trust minimized relationships, and the fact that it is a hedge. It is a non-correlated asset that will do its own thing completely irrespective of the financial system. It's just not part of that system. And as trust breaks down in the legacy financial system and as conflict gets worse and more exaggerated, people will seek to leave it. And it will happen in massive waves. So with that, we'll go ahead and close this one here. I just thought that was a really good article, per usual. A huge thank you again to Suzu and Hasu for their continued awesome work. Do not forget to check out uncommoncore.co. They really just have, they always have just really, really good stuff to read. The collection over there is great, and they are responsible for some of my favorite analogies and explanations as to why Bitcoin has value in the first place, just in the general sense of what Bitcoin makes capable if you're using it as an alternative to the current financial system and what guarantees it can actually give you. And again, part three of their Skeptic's Guide to Bitcoin series, the Independent Property Rights, Bitcoin and the Promise of Independent Property Rights, is one of my absolute favorite on that. And they talk about what the stack of Bitcoin is actually competing with as far as like the court and the property and the actual governance system that we are used to, or the thing that we think of as like a default in how society is organized, that Bitcoin is an alternative measure to that. It's a networking alternative to it. And it's one of my favorite articles. So I definitely encourage you to listen to and or read that one. I will link to both of those. I will link to all the previous episodes, actually, if I can gather them all together that we've done with these guys in the show notes. All right, guys, thank you so much for joining me. This is the Crypto Economy Podcast. And I also want to give a shout out. I have recently gotten some monthly supporters from anchor.fm. If you go to the episode, you can actually have, there's a little button that says support this show. And we have recently grabbed two new supporters, Chris and David. I won't say their last names for their privacy, but I just wanted to say thank you guys so much. That's awesome. It really validates what I'm doing here. It makes me feel good, like I'm providing value for people. And I'm going to try to figure out how to have goodies for the guys who are supporting the show monthly and actually doing that, because that's a huge thing for people to actually like offer up. Like it's a monthly subscription to something that I'm offering for free. And that's just it's a massive gesture in like what it means. So I really want to be able to offer something to the people who do that. And just wanted to give a shout out and say that I've got that coming. So thank you guys so, so much for doing that. And if anyone else would like to support the show, just go to the anchor.fm page just go straight to the show notes, and there will be a button either under just the normal The Crypto Economy page or the episode itself that says support this show. So I definitely encourage you guys to do that if you're getting value out of this. It makes a world of difference. And thank you so much to everyone who has. And lastly, the other thing that you can do to support this show is share it out with everyone you know in the crypto economy and Bitcoin space, because this is where we're going to read and talk about and discuss and explore all of the amazing stuff in the crypto economy, the new privacy technologies, how Bitcoin changes the dynamics of how we organize and cooperate in society, and all of the fascinating changes that will come with it. And the history, the cypherpunks, the people, everything that's made this possible and continue to build and make it stronger for a future that solves these massive macroeconomic problems with just powerful new networking technologies. And that's why we're here, because it's a human right. It is our right to own ourselves, our lives, and our value. And Bitcoin is beginning to make that possible in a world where that right is being lost faster and faster. So let's build the crypto economy. Let's all become digital nomads and explore this crazy new world. Thank you for joining me. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. Don't forget to share this out. I love you guys. Thank you so much. And I will catch you on the next episode. And until then, take it easy, guys.